even in 100,000 million kalpas, adding it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Dalai's words.
Good morning. Be of good cheer. That's the slogan for this morning. Be of good cheer. So think of, you know, when you've heard that slogan in your life, what context you've heard that slogan, be of good cheer.
Christmas.
Usually some kind of adversity, you know, and somebody's trying to inspire you, encourage you, be of good cheer. So that's the slogan for today, Zhang's slogan. So, you know, what I like to do is, if I repeat this enough, you'll kind of get the pattern. Remember, there's 59 slogans. So, when I do the slogans, I'll probably do an introduction. So the introduction, again, is the first point of mind training is to get to a place of where you really commit that your practice is important. You know, whatever brings you to that place. You're suffering, somebody else is suffering, old age, sickness, death, whatever brings you to that, or just the beauty and wonderment of your life. Maybe that brings you to it. And then the second is that once you decide you're on the path, the second, third point of mind training is to begin to cultivate a sense of what the Tibetans call absolute bodhicitta, or what we call in Zen is your unconditioned mind. What I was saying this morning about Harada Roshi, he says, burn yourself up with your city, burn yourself up with your meditation practice, with your breath. Have some sense of what we call and experiences our unconditioned mind. We know our conditioned mind pretty well, but what's our unconditioned mind? So what we call, Tibetans call absolute bodhicitta, this part of sort of the all-inclusive quality of our consciousness. And then when we have some stability, a little bit of stability in that, more and more we have the capacity to start to cultivate what we call relative bodhicitta, or a real specific compassion practices. Actually, usually it goes in reverse. Usually the difficulties of life come at us, and we need to have some respite from that, some space around that. And so we go to meditation practice to try to cultivate some sense of absolute bodhicitta. But relative bodhicitta, you know, the specific practice of sending and receiving, meaning that you develop more the capacity to take in suffering, let it tenderize your heart, and to give back in some skillful way what that person needs. It may be something specific, or it may be just an intention. So that's the Tonglin practices. And then we move to that we begin to feel, because it actually feels so good. We begin to have some experience that it feels good to be compassionate. You know, even though we have to be around some suffering, ours and others, that if we can do that with a sense of practice, that actually has some good feeling. We visit somebody in the hospital, and even though there's some difficulty, we have some good feeling when we leave, right? That is a good feeling to serve meals to homeless people, to visit people in the hospital, to have a kind word for ourselves and others. So we decide we want to spend more and more of our life practicing, to extend practice. So the fifth point is that once we make that commitment, that practice becomes our whole life, that we find ways to do it. We continue to access the teachings and then extend the teachings. And so that's what this fifth point is, what I've been working on for the last couple of weeks. And the slogan that two slogans that I had used before were, all dharmas come to one point. All teachings come to one point. And the one point is extend beyond your limited, narrow point of view. Begin to have the capacity to see things beyond just your own self-interest. That's what Dharma helps you to do, to begin to connect with everything and everybody. And then that teaching is balanced by the second one, because the first one is pretty hard to do, is of the two witnesses, you're the primary witness. Ultimately, you have to decide what is the path that you use to do that, to open and to extend. The teachings come at you, but you have to decide when it's appropriate, do you have the capacity to do it, to what, how much energy can you put into it, and which particular ones address you most appropriately. So that's the second slogan. Of the two witnesses, teachings, you are the primary one. You're the one that has to decide what really speaks to you. And then the third of that, of the four that are in that particular set under the fifth point of mind training is be of good cheer. Be of good cheer. So we're practicing absolute bodhicitta, we're practicing relative bodhicitta, we're really taking a look at ourselves, we're trying to work skillfully with the difficulties of life. Well, that's kind of hard work. And we need something to cheer us up in the process. So how do we move to a place of where we maintain a joyful state of mind amidst all this? So, you know, I remember that one of the seven factors of enlightenment is actually joy. One of the fruits of practice is actually supposed to be a joyful state of mind, you know. And I think about, you know, Buddha said the Four Noble Truths, you know, he starts off with saying, well, there is old age, sickness, and death. How do you deal with this? You know, how do you deal with this reality of suffering? What's the, how do you work with this? How do you get beyond it? How do you ameliorate it? How do you work with it? And so one of the things we find out is if we get sad and if we get depressed and if we get discouraged and if we give up, that's not going to work. So somehow in this practice we have to find a way to maintain a joyful state of mind amidst all the circumstances that come to us. And so I think one of the greatest teachings that I've experienced is when I'm around really seasoned teachers. When I actually find that I'm not listening to their words so much, but I'm actually watching how they are. And what I've noticed around the Dalai Lama is that he always maintains a joyful state of mind. He always has the sense of when he meets people, no matter if they're suffering or whatever, he has this capacity to be able to both empathize with them, but also has an elevated kind of spirit that he kind of blesses them. You know, I'm always reminded of that one story of Kalam Rinpoche when he was going through an aquarium, you know, in Boston, and he was touching each tank, and he was blessing. He was doing a little Tong Lin, you know, may you be happy, may you be happy. It's kind of that kind of spirit that we need to cultivate. And so it's very encouraging to me, people like the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh, that has experienced such enormous amount of suffering for their students and their people, the Vietnamese people and the Tibetan people, and yet somehow their practice has really sustained them and has really encouraged them. And so that has encouraged me, you know. So this in some ways is a little bit like, you know, be of good cheer is, what it's basically saying is lighten up. You know, it's a little bit like the one all dharmas meet at one point, which is how do you get beyond your own self-interest? The way you get beyond your own self-interest is you have to lighten up. You have to kind of let go of the heaviness of the situation in some way and try to lighten up and expand your sense of awareness. So this works in concert with that particular one. The other thing to bear in mind is that this is actually the 21st slogan out of the 59 slogans. So we're not quite halfway through yet, even though it seems that way. And in most commentaries, you know, three quarters of the book probably deal with these first 21. And then the other ones, which are more, are usually condensed more briefly. So there usually seems to be a little more emphasis in these first ones, because they found the really foundational practices for you. In other words, you've been practicing the other 21 slogans. Or in this case, you know, I probably, in here, we've probably lectured, in the last couple of years, I've probably, you know, I don't know, maybe 15 slogans, 10 slogans, something like that, you know. So you are more mature in your practice. You have more ability to know yourself. You've been practicing with yourself. You, as we say in therapy, you have more of a sense of what your strategies in life are, how you avoid difficulties, where your reactivity is, how your buttons get pushed. What is your, as we say in therapy, what is your shadow? What is your strategies for avoidance and denial? So you have some similarity with that. You know when things come at you, you can, oh yeah, this is it. This begins to feel important. This is kind of, this pushes my button. This is what this is. So it isn't something like out of the blue for you anymore. And of course, you have the third main slogan in mind training, which is practice with difficulties. Remember, the third main slogan is expect that that's how you're going to wake up. You need difficulties to wake up. And so you've been thinking, oh, okay, this is a difficulty. It's hard. I wish it wasn't here. But that's what happens. That's what practice is about. This is how I learn to apply the teachings. And you also have been practicing the second slogan, which is that you bring your difficulties to your meditation practice, and you begin to experience more of the capacity that your mind doesn't have to be compulsively turning and trying to work these problems out and being self-absorbed about them. You have some capacity to let them go and have some spaciousness. And yes, they come back, they coalesce again, they become more dense, but you have a little more of space in your meditation practice where you don't have to be thinking about this from the beginning to the end. There's little gaps and little spaces. And that's what one of the benefits of our meditation practice. We also begin to have more of a sense about how to work with impermanence. That instead of impermanence being our enemy, which is often what happens when way most people approach things in life, why is life suffering? Because we expect things to be stable and permanent. And in fact, they're not stable and they're not permanent. And as we begin to really absorb the profundity of that teaching, we begin to turn impermanence into our friend. We begin to see that that's a necessary condition for life, is impermanence. But I think that one of the difficulties of this particular slogan is, what happens when you're really angry, you're really contracted, and you're depressed? How do you practice? Because if you use this slogan to beat yourself up, like, I'm supposed to be of a joyful state of mind right now, this is just another slogan to make you feel worse, right? So there's a little bit of a paradox here in terms of how you use it. So one thing, you have to be with and feel the state that you're really in. You have to be able to be with it. And that's one of the difficulties, one of the shadow components of meditation, of spiritual practices. We can do a little bit of a spiritual bypass. We can say, I'm not supposed to feel this. I'm supposed to be a joyful state of mind, so I'm just going to ignore this is really how I feel, and I'm going to pretend I'm somewhere else. So you're not authentic. And this is difficult to actually, how do you be with where you really are, but also be attentive to how you can move out of that situation, because that's what teaching is. Our teaching gives us navigational instructions. So what this slogan really is, in some ways, it is a point of assessment. It says, I'm in this state, how could I be in a different state? It's asking you to question the state that you're in. How can I apply the other teachings to bring myself to another state So that's the most profound thing that's important. How can you work and adjust with your state of mind? So the way some teachers talk about this, in a way that Trungpa really emphasizes this, and that I really connect with, is that where the slogan comes from is, after you've been practicing for a while, you have a tremendous sense, well, more and more, you have a sense of confidence in the practice. You're realistic. You know, you're not expecting it to alleviate all the pain and suffering in your life, but you can see that it really helps. It really helps you. You know, just like a good diet isn't necessarily going to save you from, you know, every illness, but it's going to help. Just like exercise, right? It's really going to help. Well, the teachings, you begin to have more confidence in the teachings. And you begin to have a sense of gratitude for the teachings. Really deep sense of appreciation and gratitude that somebody figured this out for us. And then, even though we're the primary witness, and we have to make the selection, but they have been really offered to us. So, you know, for me, when I bow, when we do service and I bow, I really, you know, it's just not a performative thing for me. I mean, I really am feeling sometimes more profoundly than others, but I'm really feeling a sense of deep gratitude and appreciation. So even though my life may be difficult, or people's lives around me may be difficult, then I really have a sense of gratitude that there have been so many people that have practiced this, that have shown me the way that it seems to work in their lives, and that I reference that. So we have a sense that more and more that our sense of joyful state of mind or sense of equanimity isn't so determined so much anymore just on pleasant circumstances. In other words, we're only going to be happy when things go well for us, because it isn't going to happen. That's just not the way the world operates. So how can we use our practice to develop a state of mind that whatever comes at us, we can meet it with a certain sense of confidence and a certain sense of appreciation? So in Zen, you know, we have a very terse slogan, you know, sun-faced Buddha and moon-faced Buddha, which means they're both sun and moon, right? But you both are Buddha. Buddha, you know, like Suzuki Roshi said when he was dying, he said, this is just suffering Buddha right now, but still Buddha, you know. So it's always encouraging to me not only to see teachers, but you know, like this, Bonnie, but in Channel 9, I don't know if you saw this last 6 o'clock news, there's a book that's out on nurses. This one person had some difficulty, and she was so taken by the care of her nurse that she wrote a book on nurses, all the different way nursing is. And I, you know, when I ran hospice, I was always inspired. Even nurses that had difficulties in their own life and that were struggling, somehow when they went in to see the patient, their practice was to bring, they didn't bring their problems, and they brought a certain state of healing, state of mind. So that's what this is encouraging us to kind of cultivate. And of course, this isn't easy. You know, it requires a certain quality in us of being a spiritual warrior. You know, this quality doesn't necessarily come easy. We can't, you know, have sort of a wimpy attitude towards cultivating this. It takes some courage and some, you know, integrity. So, not easy, but be of good cheer. Be of good cheer. Does anybody have any comments or any questions you have about this particular slogan? How can I be of good cheer? How can I be more of good cheer right now?
My firm's business manager has a requirement on every ad she runs for an employee, so only the cheerful need apply. Seems to tie into this.
Makes a tremendous difference. You know, when I think about it, I've had lots of people when I was hiring that were very, very talented, but were just so hard to work with. You know, this kind of spirit of like, how can we work together on this? So, yeah. Yeah, it's a really, maybe, certainly as important quality, if not more important than any particular skill set that they bring. And usually when I override that and I thought, well, no, I'll hire this person because they have the skill set, but I sensed in my gut it was going to be a problem, and usually it turned out to be a problem.
That's great.
Anything else? Anything else you want to add to this, or where that slogan has come to you and how you work with that slogan?
You know, work can be a gift in that one must be present with the patient or the family and bring that. You know, and let other things go, and it's a real opportunity to be present with your patient and to be of good cheer, or positive, or receptive, and it's just such a gift to have that opportunity many times a day.
I think there's a difference for me between being happy and being peaceful, because I don't think that I'm always happy. But, you know, as life gives me challenges, I've been encouraged because I've become more peaceful in dealing with them.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if I'm cheerful, but I think I'm more peaceful.
Yeah. Well, when I read these, you know, I read when I was preparing this, I have about four commentaries. I have Wallace's commentary and Trungpa's commentary and Norman Fisher's commentary and my own commentary, and there's a couple of Tibetans. And, you know, these slogans have been lectured on. There's, you know, five or six books out there. And it's interesting that some emphasize more this quality, more the quality of like gratitude and confidence. Not so much like you're going around with a big smile on your face. But I will say that when I look at the Dalai Lama and Thich Nhat Hanh, Thich Nhat Hanh's a little harder for him to smile, actually. That's why he keeps emphasizing, have the half smile on your face, you know. You ever heard him say that thing? He says, just go neutral right now. Just neutral face. Close your eyes. Okay, now just have a little bit of that half smile. Just turn the corners of your mouth up just a little bit. Now, at first, that feels awkward. But if you stay with it, you'll notice that it has a little quality in your eyes. Your eyes start to brighten. They feel a little brighter. And so that's his practice. You know, I think he's had so much suffering in his life. And he's very... receptive. Some people are more sensitive, you know, in terms of how they are with suffering. I think he's one of those teachers, and so he's had to practice extra hard, I think, to do this, and so that's why he gives that teaching frequently. Maintain a half smile. Notice the Buddha often has a half smile on his face. So, yes, Julie.
I have a problem with that.
Which one?
That half smile.
Yeah.
And I have a problem also with this be of good cheer.
Uh-huh.
I feel like it's sort of reminds me of Christmas time.
Yeah.
And it seems, I appreciate you talking about how to work with it, because my initial response is to just really sort of not be attracted to
yeah.
it at all.
Well, good. Well, it's a very ancient slogan, right? And people have been practitioners have been practicing for a long time. And
I respect Thich Nhat Hanh. It's not that I don't respect him.
Yeah.
But anytime somebody says, put a little smile on your face,
yeah.
it does the opposite to me.
Yeah. Well, you're not, I think we all experience that. I think we all understand that. That's why one of the things that I said was, when you're not feeling that way, if you just put on a glad, a smiley face, you know, a little yellow sticker with a smiley face, which some people, I, you know, have never used that sticker and would have a hard time with that sticker. That's why it's used as a point, it's emphasized to use as a point of assessment. Like, when, if you aren't feeling a certain way, the teachings teach you to be with whatever state of mind you're in, but also to improve your state of mind. And so this is a point of assessment. And some teachers emphasize more this part, having gratitude for the teachings, some confidence in the teachings, and maybe there's ways that we encourage you to you know, work more with difficulties or to have this. I mean, I actually think if you, because you're a healer, you go in with people, right? And if you just go in and be Mr. Glad, you know, like, oh boy, wonderful, this is great, oh no, don't worry about your suffering, that isn't going to work. But if you come in and you're down and discouraged and depressed, and that's what you're giving them, and you don't give them much energy, that's not going to work. You know, I mean, you are the message. Your energy field is the message for them. And what you put into them in terms of your vibrations is what you put into them. And so you have to work with that. It's important to be able to work with that. So both are true. Don't be inauthentic. Don't do a spiritual bypass, which is kind of what you're saying. You know, like, I'm not supposed to feel these feelings, I have to have these other feelings. That's not what it's saying. It's more a sense of assessment and how you can try to use the teaching to cultivate this. Steve?
As an educator, I see a lot of teachers who bring their difficulties of life, even, you know, couples who are married. I can tell when they're having an argument, you know? And the kids can, too. So I have to kind of do that, put on a game face for the day. But for me, it's actually been a real inspiration because I had the same kind of reaction about, well, 25 years ago when the New Age stuff was around, where a lot of people kind of had that put on smile, and that really put me off.
Well, you know,
but then people like the Dalai Lama, it's so authentic that people I know that never don't even have an interest in Buddhism are taken with the man.
Yeah. So. See, the thing is that he really isn't being inauthentic. He really is able to absorb an enormous amount of suffering and somehow be able, he isn't a false sense of what he's presenting. It's really a sense, and where that comes from is, I mean, I'm just telling you my own sense, is where it comes from is a deep practice in non-duality, a deep practice of understanding emptiness, and understanding that basically the world is kind of a positive, supportive place, even amidst the suffering. You know, I mean, that's what the Buddha was teaching, is how can you enjoy life, you know. So, yeah.
Just a quick comment, and that is that I find that a lot of times when I am not particularly concentrating on something that is difficult for me or that I'm suffering with, that I, even if I'm not, don't have my attention on that, my mood carries through and, you know, my face transmits that. And I've found that probably through this practice that over the last 10 years, I am able to, when I'm not particularly working on my suffering or my state of mind, that if I do smile, it really changes my whole attitude. And, you know, to begin with, it does feel a little artificial. But when the effect changes your mood, it's no longer artificial. That's what I found.
Well, it's not, I don't mean to be prosaic, but it's like when you don't feel, you feel like no energy and you don't want to exercise, but you exercise, it changes your state of mind. Or if you feel lonely and you reach out, even though you don't want to, but you reach out in some way, you try to help, it makes you feel better. Mm-hmm. And you continually try to find that, to prove that to yourself. So maybe one more question. Bob, do you have one?
I remember kind of what Steve was saying, that when Norman Fisher was became or was about to become the abbot of the American Zen Center, and I don't know if I eavesdropped and heard them say this or read it, because one thing I decided I really had to act cheerful or be cheerful, because no one wants to see a depressed abbot at Zen Center or dragging himself around. And I thought, you know, that was a really interesting statement, because
he said that?
Yeah. And because it sort of put him in this I can really relate to it, you know. I mean, it was like, even though he was obviously a very accomplished practitioner of the path and he's an abbot, you know, he still was going through a lot of the same things that I feel in the work environment.
Well, I'm going to be a little too candid right now. If you're the kind of person that has a hard time putting smiley stickers on your probably Zen's a good practice for you, because one of the major criticisms that I've heard over the years is, why is everybody so serious? Why come people aren't smiling more? And so there is Zen practice tends to emphasize, this is more comes from Tibetan practice, although, Suzuki Roshi and most Zen teachers I know, his son and people, they really do. There are some notable exceptions, I will have to say, but most of them really, Suzuki Roshi just loved, people loved to hang out with him. He just had practice really, even though he had a tremendous amount of suffering in his life, But Zen practice tends to be a little bit more on the serious side, it emphasizes the side, like, so you're depressed, it's okay, that's your state of mind, don't fight it, just whatever your state of mind is at, and Norman tends to be, by temperament and personality, a little bit depressed. Yeah. He's very honest about it, and he says it in his book under that. He says, I tend to be by temperament a little bit this way, but practice has really helped me. He says it's really helped me be with that and also meet people with more. And so when you're with him, actually, you have a sense of both. That temperamentally, he tends to be a little bit, he isn't like one of these, woody-doody-doo. That's not the kind of teacher he is, But you also have a sense that he's something very deep coming forward, and that's what this is trying to call on. Okay, maybe that's good. May our intentions deeply extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings on our endless side are vowed to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Norma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to count. Thank you all.
Oh, can I make an announcement?
Please.
I just wanted to remind us all, as I remind myself, of the importance.